Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today's feature is about Akira Toriyama and his involvement in video games. Returning guest Josh from the video game history podcast, Still Loading, joins as we examine Toriyama's incredible legacy in the gaming industry. I promise you, it's not sad. In the game section, I look at Peach's protagonistic return in Princess Peach Showtime and give some final thoughts on Splatoon 3 Side Order. And as always, a bit of news. Let's jump right into the feature on Akira Toriyama and gaming with Josh from the Still Loading podcast. Today's feature is about Akira Toriyama and his influence on the gaming world. As you know, he unfortunately passed away at the age of 68 a few weeks ago, but his mark on anime, manga, and yes, gaming is undeniable. And don't worry, this won't be a sad segment, since we're going to celebrate his amazing contributions to gaming and dig into everything he worked on, both famous and obscure. Joining me to chat all about it is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello, it is I returning from the Game of the Year episode, Josh from the Still Loading podcast. Mono, how are you doing? And thank you for having me on again.
I'm doing great. I'm always excited to have you on. This is actually your fifth appearance on the podcast, believe it or not.
Is it a record?
You are tied with the record. So I can't give you the record just yet, but you are tied with it. I think a lot of listeners remember you from our Game of the Year episodes and our Pikmin 4 episode. But I dragged you back to chat about Akira Toriyama because, like myself, you too are a fan of his work. So I want to hear your backstory. What was your first exposure to Akira Toriyama?
I first got exposed to his work in like a lot of kids growing up in the 90s with Dragon Ball Z. But the way that I got exposed to it was I was a huge Pokemon kid growing up, and I would watch the anime in the morning. And I remember being really mad every time DBZ was on at first because it was never during the fight scenes that I saw, which now I realize it was probably like a filler episode where they just show lots of like panning shots of Namek and you're just waiting for something to happen. So I was waiting for that to end so I could watch Pokemon. And I was so mad at him. Like, I don't care about this show. Who, Dragon Ball Z? What does that even mean? Give me Pokemon. I was really angry for like a 9-year-old. About this show. And I remember finally seeing like a fight, and it was something where no one went Super Saiyan in it, but I remember seeing like a power-up scene, and then all of a sudden it was action I had never seen before in a cartoon. It blew my mind. I just could not believe what I was watching. I had never seen an American cartoon like that. I had never seen a TV show that did anything like that. It was something that I couldn't fathom. My little 8-year-old brain just could not fathom. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen and didn't know that I wanted until I saw it. I mean, I didn't know Akira Toriyama made that. You know, I had no idea. I just knew it was Dragon Ball Z. And I remember then after that discovering what Dragon Ball was. I'm like, wait a minute, there is a prequel to everything that happened in Dragon Ball Z and Goku is a kid? What is this? What is this world? And it just fascinated me ever since. So that was my first exposure to his work.
Yeah, I have a similar path. I first discovered Toriyama through Dragon Ball Z, like most people, and it aired around my home in syndication. I want to say Sunday at 6:30 a.m., Dragon Ball Z would come on. And I think this was even before it came to Cartoon Network, before Toonami. It was just in regular TV syndication. And I used to catch it if I woke up really early. It was Sailor Moon at 6 and then DBZ at 6:30. So I believe that was my first exposure to anime in general. And I was instantly a fan of DBZ because it was just so distinctly different from any other animated show in America. And before we really dig into his work, let me briefly lay some groundwork on Toriyama before we get into specifically his work on video games. He was born in Aichi Prefecture in Japan, which is around the middle of the country, and his first big hit was Dr. Slump in 1978, which is a comedy manga. I think maybe a lot of people, if you haven't read it, you might know the character Arale. She is from Dr. Slump. And he followed that up with, of course, Dragon Ball in 1984, which ran until 1995. And during that time and afterwards, he also worked on many video games as a character designer. So, Josh, how would you even go on to describe his art? What would you say are some of the key elements of his style? And why do you think people connect so much with his art?
What I would say is that his designs are very unique. I'm playing Dragon Quest for the first time and kind of like I've been meaning to for quite some time. But once he passed, I'm like, all right, I should really get on that. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the things I'm noticing now, granted, I'm playing the Super Famicom version of the original Dragon Quest. So there it's some updated graphics, but all of the monsters and the designs of the monsters are so unique and so varied and so interesting. And one of the things I'm really enjoying about the game so far is that I can tell what type of fight I'm going to get based off the monster I'm fighting. And part of that is game design, but the designs are so striking. Like if I fight a wolf man, I know exactly what type of enemy I'm going to have, how many hit points it has already because it's hard coded in. And the designs are so unique that it makes it easier to memorize those types of things. Whereas I wouldn't say the same for like other enemies in other JRPGs. Like I love Final Fantasy. It's one of my favorite series, but I don't remember a lot of the generic enemies in those games. In Dragon Quest One, I'm already memorizing the Wolfman. I'm memorizing obviously the iconic slime. So I think one of the hallmarks of Toriyama's design is just how strong they are and how unique they are. Dragon Quest was based off of like Dungeons and Dragons and kind of like Wizardry and Ultima specifically, which in turn is based off of tabletop games. So when you think about a slime in like a D&D campaign, it's usually this acidic blob that kind of has maybe some eyeballs in it or something like that to see you. And it's just kind of floating in goo. And it's really kind of like grotesque looking. But they send that over to Toriyama and he makes it cute. It's a little tiny Hershey Kiss looking thing with a smiley face and two eyeballs on it. And it's not something you would expect. He's able to subvert your expectations, but still make the designs work. And that to me, that's almost like his hallmark. What kind of stands out of his designs is that he can subvert your expectations, but it never takes away from the overall intention of whatever he is working on.
Yeah, I totally agree. And for a lot of Americans, especially, his art style feels like the default anime art style. And it was for a time in the 90s. When you think of, oh, what is the anime art style? You're thinking of Toriyama. You're thinking of the big spiky hair, which is common in a lot of anime. But you could say that Toriyama, if he didn't invent it, he at least really popularized it. Or he expresses his characters through their hairstyle, which I definitely want to get into more when we talk about specific games. And I also think his characters often having very simplistic, but oftentimes eclectic fashion really stands out. Many of his characters, they're basically just wearing fairly simple, like a jumpsuit or normal clothing. But there's always a twist on it or some feature that really stands out. I always think of the Saiyan armor, which, like, how would you even describe it? It doesn't really look like anything I've seen before. It's both very simple in terms of its aesthetic, but also you're not going to mistake it for something else. And I think that's the reason why he managed to become popular in Japan and America is that his art, you know it when you see it. You never think, oh, did Toriyama make this? You just know.
I also remember when I first got into DBZ that I had never seen art like that in like at all. Because like I said, when I first saw Dragon Ball Z, all it was just wide shots, wide panning shots of Namek. But then when Goku comes on and he powers up and his hair changes, I remember hearing that the voice actor for Goku, the American voice actor, or North American dub of DBZ or whichever dub, I don't know which one, but the voice actor for Goku for the scene where he had to go Super Saiyan 3 passed out from yelling so much. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not going to say that is like a definitive fact. I do find that story a little amusing, but that lends to the mystique that the show had where there was so much in this world that you did not know and did not understand. And the designs just lend to it, like the capsule core thing, right? Like, that's such a cool idea where it's like, you know, little machines inside little capsules that captured my imagination. They just throw that and a motorcycle pops out. I'm like, what is this? I think the designs of it were so strong and like specifically the facial animations and the face designs and the hair and everything with the head, because I had never seen cartoons with that much detail. Where veins were popping out of their face or arms and their hair had more lines. It was just this really cool aesthetic. And I'll never forget that. Like, it just something that has stuck with me all these years later. It was one of the things that stuck out to me about it. And that traces back to Toriyama and his designs.
So we've laid some groundwork on who he is and how he became famous, but let's look at his contributions to the world of video games. Josh, do you want to take a shot and guess what was the first video game to use Akira Toriyama's designs?
I would assume Dragon Quest, but maybe there's something earlier, but I'm 99% certain it's Dragon Quest.
And you are right. It is Dragon Quest, which launched in May of 1986. And I did wonder if a Dragon Ball game came out first, but the first Dragon Ball game was in September of 1986 for the Super Cassette Vision. It only had 30 games, but it did have the first Dragon Ball game ever. And in November of that same year, there was a Famicom game called Dragon Ball Shenlong's Riddle, which actually did come out to the States, retitled as Dragon Power. He came out swinging when he entered the world of video games. And it seems that recently you've been playing the original Dragon Quest games, right?
Yes, for the very first time. I have never played a single one, and I'm playing through the first one right now.
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of backstory on how he got involved with Dragon Quest. It just seemed like Enix wanted him because he was the biggest manga artist in Japan at the time. And also Toriyama's editor really encouraged him to do it. But he ended up being a perfect fit since he is the master of creating characters that are very simplistic in detail, but they all look very different, have very distinct silhouettes. And the box art and the other promo material, obviously it looks different from the in-game graphics, but like you said earlier, you are able to tell that Toriyama designed it because he expresses his characters through their visual design in just such a unique way. And they manage to stand out even with these very simple pixel graphics. So we talked about some of the enemy designs that you said you liked earlier. Are there any other Dragon Quest designs that really stand out from you, either from the games you're playing now or ones you've seen before in the past?
A lot of artwork was shared around Twitter when Toriyama passed, and a lot of stuff from Dragon Quest V, like the artwork from that game, really stood out to me, and I've heard nothing but good things about that game. I guested on this series called King of Games, and it's a friend's podcast, Retro Hangover. I'm going to try to really paraphrase this down because otherwise I'll go on a long-winded thing that's not directly Toriyama related. But they did a series called King of Games, and they do it every year. King of Games 92, which came out last year to the public. And it was basically like we looked at all the games that were released in 92. In this, they had Dragon Quest V, and that game was like the way people talked about it in that series, it was like something magical about it. So when I started seeing all of the artwork from that game, I think Nadia Oxford posted something about it, and it stuck out to me. I just think his artwork for that series is just really beautiful, and it's something that I always meant to get into, but because the early Dragon Quest games were on the NES and I've heard of how obtuse they were compared to modern standards, it always scared me away, but I'm finally diving into it. So it's, I don't know, Dragon Quest V, the artwork for it, I'm actually trying to try to find it on Nadia's page now because it was key art from it, and you see like a giant tiger or like a cheetah, a saber-toothed tiger, I should say. Standing behind this guy wearing a purple cloak and a staff, it's very striking, and there's just this adorable little slime looking off into the distance at the people's feet. I'm enjoying my playthrough of this first game, and I'm planning on doing 1 through 3 back to back on my Twitch streams, so I'm working through them bit by bit, and who knows, when I stream this tomorrow I might actually beat the first one. Apparently the first one's not that long. Anyway, the artwork, I agree with what you said earlier, really stands out.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Dragon Quest V main character design. That's not a typical character design. If you were given the task of, okay, design a hero for a JRPG, I think most artists are not going to come up with the design of the Dragon Quest V character. He's got like a purple headscarf and a staff. It's just so different from what you would expect, which is, I think, one of Toriyama's great strengths is that, like you said before with the slime, he was told, okay, in Wizardry and Ultima and all the other monster manuals, this is what the slime looks like. It's just a pile of goop. And I want you to translate that into your art style. But he kind of went like a totally different path. And for me, a lot of other iconic Dragon Quest designs, of course, the slime, which we all love. And I do like the variations as well, like the King slime, which is just a big fat slime, and the metal bubble, which is like a melted, like looks like liquid metal. And some of my other favorites, the Erdrick, the Orloto, the character from Dragon Quest III, in his blue plate armor. That's basically the default JRPG hero look, I think. And I also like the Dragon Quest IV female design because she looks quite tough and she has these big muscular tree trunk legs. And it's such a bold design, which we talked about before. They don't feel like they are designed by committee, I want to say. It feels like really singular in their vision. Sorrow from Dragon Quest also looks amazing. And he is basically a proto Sephiroth, which we'll talk about later on, about all his designs and really important characters and important games that were inspired by his designs. If you look at Sorrow, the human version, and you look at Sephiroth, it's hard to believe that Nomura, the artist for Final Fantasy, did not see Sorrow and say, I should make a design similar to that. Dragon Quest in general just really has incredibly consistently good character designs. Even up to 11, all the characters are so singular and unmistakable. And it's pretty incredible that he could just work on dozens of these games in the same series and make so many standout designs over three decades. I can't even think of another artist working on a game series that long and putting out so many amazing designs.
And the fact that you can tell it's all him, right? Like, it's unmistakable that it's his style. And sometimes, you know, some people, like, you look at artists who can adapt to lots of different styles and become a chameleon and you don't know it's them. That's also really cool. But I think it's a credit when there's an artist whose style is so noticeable. The moment you see it, you know who drew it. It's almost a credit to how well they have built up their repertoire as well as their design skill over the years, where they can take their style, make it feel like their own, but then adapt to so many different scenarios. Kind of also, this is kind of super random, but when you were asking before about like what's part of his design work that stands out, and I mentioned like the details and the hair and stuff like that. Also muscles. He draws muscles really well.
Oh, yeah. It's both really absurdly muscular, but also quite lean. Unless you're Broly, and then you're popping out of the screen with your muscles. But yeah, that's a good observation. Nobody really draws muscles like him. I guess we should jump into his other big game, Chrono Trigger. Many pitch it as being developed by an all-star team of Japanese devs. And it goes without saying that if you're looking for an all-star character designer, you got to get Toriyama. What are your thoughts on Toriyama's work on Chrono Trigger?
It's fantastic. Chrono Trigger was literally, as I said before, like, you can recognize Toriyama's artwork immediately. When I saw the artwork for Chrono Trigger, I'm like, hey, that looks like Dragon Ball Z, before I knew Toriyama was a part of either of them. I'm like, that's interesting. Why does this look like Dragon Ball Z? I had no idea at the time. And playing Chrono Trigger, I played it for the first time, I want to say, like a decade ago, like 2014, maybe 2013 or 2012, something like that, a little over a decade ago. And it's just like that game, it's one of the best games I've played, just one of the best RPGs I've played. And not, you know, a lot of people will say that and it's based off nostalgia. I don't have nostalgia for that game. I didn't play it as a kid. I didn't have a Super Nintendo as a kid. I came to it as an adult and it still blew me away. And the designs, the artwork in that game is just beautiful. Like, absolutely beautiful. There's so many moments in that game, like the campfire scene in Chrono Trigger. One of the, I have a shadow box frame of that moment in my game room right here, where some of the trees are raised up off of the backdrop. The characters are raised up. It's just such an iconic moment. And I don't think it would look nearly as iconic if it wasn't for Toriyama's designs.
Yeah, you mentioned the campfire scene. Right now I'm playing Unicorn Overlord, and one of the pieces of promo art is a campfire scene. And every time, and it's no coincidence, I think, that they're invoking that image, because anytime there's a campfire scene in a JRPG, it's probably because of Chrono Trigger. And that really goes to show you his influence on just so many other titles and so many other games. And Chrono Trigger, I think maybe a lot of younger gamers, maybe it doesn't hold that level of esteem or that level of fame for them. But if you grew up in the 90s or even 2000s, Chrono Trigger, it is kind of the default, like, quote unquote, greatest RPG of all time or greatest JRPG of all time. It's up there with like Final Fantasy VII in terms of, okay, this was a popular classic game. And so it's pretty crazy that, especially for American audiences, the default anime is what? Dragon Ball. And the default JRPG is what? Maybe Chrono Trigger. And Toriyama is so involved with both of them. So it's hard to ignore him, is what I want to express. He's a lot of people's first exposure to different genres. If you're being introduced to anime, it's probably through Dragon Ball, at least in the 90s. And also, if you're being introduced through JRPGs, it's probably Final Fantasy VII, but number two is probably Chrono Trigger.
or Dragon Quest or some other JRPG series or game that he worked on.
Yeah. And I think, again, his work on Chrono Trigger is very emblematic of his strengths as an artist. You understand so much about every single character just by looking at them, which you talked about earlier for the Dragon Quest monster designs. And like I said earlier, his art is so suited to being translated into a more simplistic style of pixel art because it does capture the spirit and the key elements of his designs, like the big eyes, the wild hairstyles, the simple clothing. It doesn't feel like his design elements are lost when they're translated into video game graphics. And just think of all the amazing character designs in Chrono Trigger. You've got Chrono, Magus, Robo, Isla, who's really just a cavewoman in a bikini, but he does so much with the concept visually. Do you have a favorite design in Chrono Trigger?
Do I? Oh, man. Honestly, Frog, maybe?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I didn't even mention Frog. That's a big mistake on mine. But yeah, why do you love Frog so much?
It's just because it's a design that shouldn't work. Mm. Like, it's a frog that's semi-anthropomorphic, but it also wields a sword. It just, it's a really, like, when I think about Chrono Trigger, other than Chrono itself, I was tempted to say Chrono because, but he's on the cover. So I didn't want to go with like just the generic answer. So I decided to go with the frog just because it's so unorthodox, but it works so well. I Frog is awesome. I also think, who is it? I like Robo. I think yeah. Robo is a fun design as well. And Chrono just looks like something straight out of Dragon Ball Z, but I don't mean that as an insult. I really like Chrono's design as well.
So we've talked about two of his most famous works in terms of gaming, Dragon Quest and Chrono Trigger, but let's dig into some of the more obscure stuff. He often designed characters for games that he wasn't really involved in. He designed a character named Dark Raid for Famicom Jump 2, and another character called B-Man 500 SS for Chōsoku Henkei Gyro Zetter. A game I can't say I've played, sorry, but it is kind of funny to see where else has Toriyama popped up in gaming. And he also designed a diorama for Fantasian. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this game, Josh, but it is a JRPG for Apple Arcade. And all the backgrounds, they're pre-rendered, but they are realistic dioramas, like photographs, mm-hmm. I believe. And so he designed one of those, which, you know, you wouldn't expect him to do. You would think, okay, maybe he designed a character. But to make a whole diorama shows that, oh, he's quite multi-talented. And he also worked on the Blue Dragon series for Mistwalker and Xbox. Have you ever played a Blue Dragon game?
I have not, but I actually bought the original Blue Dragon game just a couple months ago before I knew Toriyama best. I actually have it in my game room here, and I've been meaning to give it a try, but I figured before I try Blue Dragon, I should work on his first iconic series of Dragon Quest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've been meaning to give it a shot at some point, just have not gotten around to it. He also did designs for Tobol.
Oh yeah, I'm definitely going to mention
Tobol 1 and 2.
Yes. I definitely want to talk about Tobol, but going back to Blue Dragon for a little bit, I think a lot of people maybe forgot about this franchise, but it was a big swing for Xbox in terms of having something appealing to the Japanese market and also filling the JRPG gap on the hardware. The 360, it was super popular in America, and it was at the time, I guess, relatively popular in Japan compared to all the other Xbox consoles before and after. So they were making a big attempt to, you know, okay, we have Japanese games on our hardware. Look, we have a JRPG series with Toriyama. And if you want a game that screams JRPG, you might as well hire Toriyama.
And made by Hironobu Sakaguchi from yes. Final Fantasy. Like, so, it brought them all back together again.
Yeah. It's definitely Chrono Trigger adjacent, if you think about it. And yeah, going back to what you mentioned, Tobol number 1 and 2, another franchise I think a lot of people probably forgot, but he created the character designs for this fighting game series. Again, putting you on the spot, have you played the Tobol series?
No. No. They're fighting games, right?
Yes.
The games that I've played that have Toriyama somehow imprinted on it are obviously Try Not Dragon Quest, Chrono Trigger, Dragon Ball Z Budokai. I played a lot as a kid. Mm-hmm. Also, I saw this on Twitter. I don't know if this is true or not, but someone showed a picture of Dr. Slump. I think the main character from Dr. Slump, I'm not sure. It was like she was in a specific pose with little wings on her hat.
Yeah, a Raleigh.
And right next to it, it showed Mario 3. And I bring that up because, you know, we're talking about games that Toriyama worked on, but this is a game that Toriyama kind of had a hand in without actually being hired for. It's almost identical. Like, the pose is almost identical to what you see on the Mario 3 box art. And it very much seems like Miyamoto was at least inspired by Toriyama and his design in Dr. Slump, which was popular at the time they were developing Super Mario Bros. 3.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of his influence in other games that he had nothing to do with, but it's really hard to look at those games and then look at Toriyama's art and say there's no connection. There's definitely a connection. There's definitely a big influence. And I want to mention a few of those. But before we move on to that, I want to touch on Tobol a little bit more, because his designs for Tobol are a bit interesting because they're undeniably Toriyama's art style, but they seem a bit more realistic, or I guess less jolly, maybe. They seem more serious than his other designs, which kind of makes them stand out, ironically, though. And actually, the box art for Tobol number 1 in the US does not feature his artwork. It's just the 3D models. And this is actually kind of a common theme for a lot of the early Toriyama games in America. For example, Dragon Quest came to America as Dragon Warrior. And if you look at the Dragon Warrior art for NES, it's Western-looking art that they redid. It does not show Toriyama's art. If you look at the Japanese box art for Dragon Quest 1, 2, 3, it's unmistakably Toriyama's fantastic artwork. But they thought, oh, this is too Japanese, too anime. Let's change it to make it more like generic Western. It's kind of funny to think about when Dragon Quest came to America, they didn't use Toriyama's art, or they didn't market it. Tobol, when that comes to America, they didn't use Toriyama's art on the cover. And yeah, going back to Dragon Power, the first Dragon Ball game for the Famicom, Josh, if you have a computer in front of you, please look up Dragon Power NES. Look up that artwork. And this is a Dragon Ball game. And I want you to tell me if this invokes the feeling of Dragon Ball at all.
The American box art, not even in the slightest.
Can you describe it? What is it for listeners who have never seen it?
It looks like a dude straight out of the Karate Kid doing a high-flying karate kick into the screenshot of the game with a big dragon kind of swooping and swirling behind him and behind the logo, breathing fire at the top. It's a very Americanized 80s, generic 80s box art for a game. And looking at what the Japanese Famicom box art was, just wow. The North American is so much worse.
Yeah, the Japanese box, it looks like you would expect. It has like the Shenlong, the dragon, then it has Goku kind of jumping out in a really dynamic pose. And this, actually, I looked at this the other day, and if you look at the Dragon Quest II box art for the Japanese one, the first Dragon Ball game, and the Dragon Quest II box art, they look kind of similar. I know they are both Toriyama, but the pose of the main character seems like very identical. I don't know if this is an intentional callback, but it is fun to look at. Toriyama, his games entered the scene, but until Dragon Ball gets into more circulation in the late 90s, that's when developers or publishers think, okay, we can use Toriyama's art as a major marketing point. Because before, we deliberately erased it, but now we realize, okay, Americans actually do like this art style. And I guess we should probably talk about Dragon Ball games. They're all based on his work. And he has designed some brand new characters for Dragon Ball video games. He did Android 21 for Dragon Ball FighterZ, Mira and Toas for Dragon Ball Online, and Bonyu for Dragon Ball Kakarot. Do you have a favorite Dragon Ball game?
I played a lot of Dragon Ball Z Budokai.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that because that game followed the story of Dragon Ball Z. So it was like you were playing through the show again. And I actually thought they did a really good job of, in terms of like pacing. The only thing that I hated was there was a mini game in it, the beginning part of the Saiyan saga where you meet Raditz, you know, Goku's brother. I think Raditz is Goku's brother, if I remember correctly. It's been a long time since I've watched the show. And, you know, in the show, Raditz is more powerful than Goku and Piccolo. But Goku figures if he can hold on to Raditz and like hold him, I think he even pulls his tail to like make him like be unable to move due to pain. He like gets him into a lock, and that gives Piccolo enough time to use his special beam cannon to kill Raditz, but also in turn kill Goku. And it's the way they make you do it in the game is that you have to wait for Piccolo to charge up his shot, and you constantly have to, like, Raditz is trying to move left and right, and you have to keep him in the center within the path of the shot. And I'm like, it was one of the most obnoxious things ever because you could not keep him still for the life of you. I did a little bit better when I replayed it a couple of years ago, but man, that section was one of the most aggravating points of gaming in my entire life. I still remember the rage from that to this day.
Yeah, I also played a lot of the Budokai games, and they are making a fourth one, I believe. I don't remember if it's called Budokai 4. They are continuing that series. And Dragon Ball, obviously, is based on a comic and anime, but It does feel like a game series in itself. You don't need to know anything about the franchise to enjoy the games. And so many people keep saying, either ironically or unironically, Goku for Smash Brothers. And it does feel like Goku is kind of an honorary video game character, despite coming from comics, because there are just so many Dragon Ball games, and they've managed to reach people who are not really even into Dragon Ball. There's up and down in terms of the quality of the Dragon Ball games, but there are quite a lot of good ones. The Budokai series, Fighters, which it was like a real big breakthrough, both for Arc System Works, and also kind of revitalized Dragon Ball a bit in terms of popularity. Some Dragon Ball games I like Dragon Ball Origins for the DS, which is based on the original Dragon Ball series. And it is kind of like a Zelda. I would definitely recommend people check it out if you can get your hands on it. It's not very long, and it's pretty simplistic in terms of gameplay. But the art style, again, how many times do we need to say Toriyama's art style looks amazing when you translate it to the games? And I want to touch on some games and characters that he inspired. You mentioned before, Arale from Dr. Slump, her running style maybe inspired Super Mario's running style in Super Mario Brothers 3. And any character that with any sort of Super Saiyan, any character that shot a beam out of their hand or teleported behind someone, they're paying homage to the master, Super Sonic. This is just a ripoff of Super Saiyan, right? Like, there's no denying it.
I mean, it's a direct ripoff, but done in a loving way, I would argue.
Of course, it's not trying to hide anything.
No.
So you mentioned Mario before, but are there any games or characters or artists that you feel like were inspired by Toriyama's works?
I mean, throw a stick and you're going to find one, because it's after he passed, like the amount of other mangaka, is that the right term?
Yeah,
mangaka. Who were saddened by the loss of him and who credit him for getting a kickstarting their careers is just staggering. Like so many people have been influenced by him, and it's hard to really think about. I can tell you right now for myself, I'm not an artist, but I did want to be at one point in time. I would trace over DBZ characters over and over again and draw them from sight until I could memorize the design. Now, I'm not a good artist, like I said, so if you ask me to draw Goku in a different position other than the one that I saw him in, nah, it's not happening. But my youngest brother, he got into art and drawing because of Dragon Ball Z. So I feel like Toriyama and my brother, none of my brothers are like artists in that sense, but the fact that my youngest even got the farthest out of all of us in terms of like trying to practice and hone his craft is better than I can say for what I did. And the fact like that's just with him. There's so many people who have been influenced by him.
Yeah. One that I always like to bring up that a lot of people don't notice until they look for it, but Ken Sugimori's early designs. Ken Sugimori, obviously known for his work on the Pokemon franchise. But if you look at his pre-Pokemon work, and especially Pokemon Gen 1, he does seem like he is imitating Toriyama. And listeners might think they're nothing alike, but look up the Gen 1 Red art style and then tell me that Red does not look like a Dragon Ball character. He's got the sharp eyes. He's got the spiky hair. He's got the pointy shoes.
Gary kind of has a little bit of Toriyama in him, definitely. Like that design.
Yeah. The Toriyama eyes, I think of, they're just big white boxes with these black pupils, oftentimes kind of very angry looking. And Sugimori obviously evolved his art style over the years, but Toriyama definitely had a huge influence on Pokemon. And that series largely became popular because of its excellent designs, which are somewhat Toriyama adjacent. I don't think it's a coincidence that, okay, in the late 90s, Americans are really interested in Dragon Ball and they're interested in Pokemon. A lot of people maybe are not making the connection between the two art styles, but there probably is some sort of subconscious thing there where they think, okay, I like both of these things because the art is somewhat similar or it stands out in such a
unique
way. I
never put that together. Yeah. Like I can see it now. I did read about Sugimori's influence being influenced by Toriyama, but I forgot about it. And then I also didn't put it together really specifically until you look at even like the cartoon, the anime of Pokemon. Ash has big, bright, expressive eyes. All the characters have big, bright, well, except Brock, but all the characters have big, bright, expressive eyes. And that's a very Toriyama thing. I never thought of that.
Yeah, especially his eyes are like a black pupil and then white. It's not like the typical anime eyes where it's like more multicolored. So yeah, you really don't think about it until you specifically look for it. I always think of, definitely look at the shoes. Those are some Dragon Ball-esque shoes that everyone is wearing in Generation 1. So yeah, Sonic, Pokemon, Street Fighter, you know, Hadouken is Kamehameha. I mean, there's no hiding that. Those are just a few of the series that owe more than just a little bit to Akira Toriyama. So yep. Before we wrap up, do you have any closing thoughts on Akira Toriyama's works or his legacy, or how do you think people will remember him?
Did you see my big Twitter thread? I don't know if you saw that at all. If you don't mind, I could just read it off. I feel like it tells a bit of a personal story. It also helped me pinpoint my emotions on his passing. So Here's what I wrote. I've been reflecting more on Akira Toriyama's passing and why it's hit me harder than I expected. Celebrity deaths don't always get me in the feels. Very few do, but this one hurts. Growing up, I was made fun of for liking Dragon Ball Z. The whole anime is weird and therefore bad trope that was used to mock geeks. Thankfully, it didn't stop me from liking it, but it did stop me from talking about it since I didn't want to be made fun of. Once I was old enough, probably around 13 or 14, I started going on mission trips to Mexico. We would go to a small orphanage and help them out with projects that needed to get done, roofing, putting up fences, plumbing work, all that kind of stuff. After work was done for the day, we would spend the rest of the afternoon / evening playing with the kids, and most of the time we would end up playing soccer with them, but a few times we had some arts and crafts stuff planned. During one of those arts and crafts sessions, I decided to start drawing Goku from Dragon Ball Z. I was obsessed with DBZ. I would trace over pictures of Dragon Ball Z characters until I could draw it from memory. And this is actually when I go into the little story I said before, where if you ask me to draw them in a different pose, I couldn't do it. I was stuck doing that one pose for whichever character I was drawing. But that didn't matter, because once I had finished drawing it, a few kids came over to look. They started saying Goku excitedly and then mimicked the Kamehameha blast. I honestly was in shock, because I grew up in a small, sheltered town that didn't have much of a concept of the world outside of my little bubble. And finding out that kids in a different country not only knew Dragon Ball Z, but also liked it, was amazing to me. I had thought for so long that not a lot of people liked anime, / it wasn't cool to like it. This, to me, is what Toriyama did for the world. This was his legacy. He made art so universally loved that it crossed cultural and language barriers. It helped me connect with kids that I couldn't even speak the same language as, and gave us a connection. As a sheltered shy geek who grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, Toriyama opened up the world to me and helped me connect with others that I wouldn't have been able to. And I can't thank him enough for that. That's what Toriyama means to me. And I think it's why his passing has hit the world so hard, because the internet is very polarizing in general. It's either the happiest place on earth or the worst place on earth. And it's very seldom that you can get the internet to be united on something. I want to say it was a Latin American country, maybe like Argentina or Chile or something like that. I don't remember which one. There was an official announcement from either the president or the government that there was going to be the National Day of Mourning or something like that. That doesn't happen for someone from a completely different country caused another country to have a National Day of Mourning or some type of thing like that. That's crazy. And his legacy is just, there's not enough words or time in the day to express how much of a legacy he's leaving and how saddening it is that he honestly passed away too young, and there's still work he was working on and he'll never get to finish. And I mean, I'm obviously most sad for his family and loved ones, but what a legacy to leave behind.
Yeah, I think a lot of people definitely share your sentiments and experiences. It is hard to overstate his importance on so many different genres and so many different peoples, so many different countries. He was the first manga artist to kind of break through from Japan to the world. So definitely a lot of people, not just in Japan, but all over the world, have been impacted by his art. And his legacy will definitely continue in video gaming. Of course, Dragon Ball games will never end. And also Dragon Quest, that series will keep going. I think, I don't want to make any predictions, but I'm pretty sure even in Dragon Quest 15 or 16 or 17 down the line, they're not going to change the art style. It will still be Toriyama adjacent. They might have Toyotaro, which does the art for the Dragon Ball Super manga, continue on. But I definitely think we will see his art for many, many years, many, many decades to come. So listeners, that was our chat on Akira Toriyama and his influence on gaming. Honestly, we really just scratched the surface, because it's really hard to overstate his contributions. But listeners, I hope you enjoyed our chat. So Josh, from the Still Loading Podcast, where can people find you?
Well, first off, thank you again for having me on, Mono. I always love coming on your show, and I'm happy that I kept this under an hour of recording time. Usually when I'm on, we're going for like almost 2 hours straight. So I'm happy that I'm making your editing work a little bit lighter this time around. So where you can find me, you can find the Still Loading Podcast, you know, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much any podcatcher you use, it should be there. And if it's not, let me know. I'll get it on there. But yeah, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, at Still Loading Pod, Twitch, at Still Loading Pod. So if you want to follow along with my Dragon Quest playthrough, I stream generally every Tuesday and Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you want to follow along with my streams, I will be playing Dragon Quest 1 through 3 straight over there. And I'll be playing some more 1 very soon. And maybe by the time this comes out, I'll be on to 2. But yeah, that's it. Yeah, thank you again for having me on, man. And if I'm back for the Game of the Year episode, I remember last time you said I had a very eclectic blend of games. And boy, you just wait for this year, Mono.
Oh, yeah.
You just wait.
Can't wait.
I've already beaten 10 games and they're all vastly different.
Oh, awesome. I'm looking forward to it. So the links to everything are in the podcast description. So check it out. Josh from the Still Loading Podcast, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Nintendo's big March game is Princess Peach Showtime, but it's not developed by The Big N. Instead, it's a Goodfill joint. You probably know them as the devs of various craft-related Yoshi and Kirby games, Wario Land Shake It, Monkey Barrels, which I did talk about before on the podcast, and recently the Goemon-inspired Mameda no Bakeru. And this game has a big Goemon connection, as the director is Atsunobu Ebisu. He's the founder and current president of Goodfill, having spun off from Konami years ago. He was very involved in the Gunbody Goemon franchise, and the last game he directed was Mystical Ninja starring Goemon for the N64. So it's been over 20 years since he's been in the director's chair. This was a pretty surprising revelation. Why, after all these years, did he decide to get more hands-on with the game? Typically, the president of a company isn't also the director. Again, please, where are the interviews, Nintendo? I need those Ask a Dev articles. Maybe there will be something in Nintendo Dream, though. That's definitely an underrated source of great Nintendo-related dev interviews. At its announcement, I thought it was exciting that Peach was getting another shot at starring in a game. While she's technically playable in what? Probably at least 2 dozen games by now? Many have craved to see her in a starring role. We did get Super Princess Peach on the DS, which many say was mediocre. And of course, they gave her the questionable emotion power-ups. I think using emotions as a power-up in a game is a neat idea on paper, but it's something that you should probably give to Kirby instead of Peach. But thankfully, in Showtime, her powers are much more intriguing than, you know, crying. So, Princess Peach Showtime, at its core, is a 2D action title. It does feel like this game is designed to be somebody's first game ever. Mechanically, it's very simple. It's an A-B game. You're not going to be pressing X, you're not going to be pressing Y, just forget about those buttons. Now, while the game is pretty simple in terms of the gameplay mechanics you need to keep track of, the game certainly has a lot of creativity and charm. If you go into the game knowing that it's not Mario or Kirby, it's instead a breezy experience with some fun gameplay segments and some nice visuals, I think you'll end up liking it. The premise is that Peach is invited to a show, but then, of course, is taken over by evil grapes. Everyone predicted this. So Peach has to save the day by entering different stages inside the theater and then don a new outfit that bestows her unique powers. You then use these powers to clear the stage, fight some enemies, solve some puzzles, then rinse and repeat. It has shades of both Kirby and Luigi's Mansion. Like Kirby, you get powers that completely change your moveset, and like Luigi's Mansion, you ascend a fancy building where each floor, or more specifically level, has a distinct theme with bespoke challenges. I think people were wondering if Showtime would be Peach's Luigi's Mansion, a spinoff to Mario that doesn't star him, and has completely unique gameplay that highlights the personality of the protagonist. I would say Showtime succeeds on this front, but in terms of quality, Luigi's Mansion 3 is far above this game. A little unfair, though, since that series has been around much, much longer. Maybe Peach's Showtime 3 will be a legit Game of the Year contender. Nothing stopping it. Each level has Peach explore a stage in 2D, and then eventually she gets a costume swap that lets her get new powers. These mostly involve a new melee attack, but some stages are not combat-focused at all. There's a detective outfit where you need to walk around and investigate a scene, using your power to reveal secrets or to accuse someone. There's also the Pâtissier power-up, where you need to essentially play a Mario Party minigame, where you decorate cakes by squeezing out icing from a big tube. I really like how they aren't all just different types of attacks. The ice skating one turns into a rhythm game, and there's a pretty funny boss battle where you essentially dance the man to death. The game has great pacing since each level isn't too long, and on a floor you have 4 or so options to choose from, so it's up to the player to determine what order they want to do the stages. I try to go back and forth between the attacking stages and the more puzzle or minigame-focused ones. So far, my favorite power-up is easily the ninja. She has all the ninja moves you'd want. Dash attack, stealth, hiding under the water and breathing through a bamboo tube. If they make an entire Peach ninja game, hey, that could be Showtime too. Princess Peach Ninja Origins. I think I like the ninja because it has more abilities than a lot of the other costumes I've come across so far. Sword Fighter is really just attack and dodge. Patissier is very context sensitive. Cowgirl has a lasso where you can pull and throw things. All of these are integrated smartly into the game, but Ninja was the only one that really surprised me in terms of the moveset. It's not a Kirby level of variety in terms of skills, that's for sure. In typical Goodfield fashion, there's a ton of collectibles in each level. You get coins where you can buy things in the hub, sparkles that are the core collectible, and a ribbon that unlocks more costumes. Unless you play very slowly and actively seek them out, you aren't getting all the collectibles the first time around. Many are very well hidden, and there are some auto-run segments where you can easily bypass one if you're not paying attention. I have to imagine the game is pretty short, but for people who want to 100% it, there's at least a lot of things to find. Oh, and I was very excited to see that yes, you can also change Peach's base dress. So far, she just still has her iconic pink dress, but you can find or buy new patterns. I'm rocking the ninja one with the Sakura and Cloud patterns. Your little assistant, Stella, can also change her dress colors, but they're far more boring. The format and structure of the game is very well thought out. There's so much variety in the gameplay due to having stages completely centered around a specific power-up. Thankfully, they're not just one and done either. For example, there are multiple Sword Fighter stages, so you don't just try on all the costumes once and then you're done. Levels have a lot of cool set pieces, like one that has Cowgirl Peach chasing down bandits on a horse, and you have to lasso each of the bandits off a horse. Another one has you surf on a giant wooden wave while you crash through the stage. The game is more focused on action segments on big set pieces than Twitch platforming, which does tie into the theatrical theming, and it's a bit easier for younger gamers since they don't need to nail the precision platforming. Oh, and that reminds me, the theater aesthetic of the game works really well. It's always neat to see the scene shift or go underneath the stage and see all the ropes and pulleys and lights. I do wish they would lean into it a bit more, though. I want the sets to look really like sets somebody put together and less like a video game area. But when they focus on the theater look, they pull it off quite well. Showtime has a lot going for it, but it's hard not to think they could have done more with it. Again, going back to Kirby, compare any Sword Kirby moveset to Peach's Sword Fighter moveset. Both Showtime and Kirby games do kind of focus on obliterating enemies, but Kirby gives you so many amazing abilities to do so, while Peach's combat ones, while still kind of neat, are very simplistic. I'm enjoying the game because I like bright, easy games that are cute and charming, but people who want more depth to their gameplay mechanics might be left thinking, is this it? But again, I have to imagine this game is designed with the idea of, okay, this is going to be some 6-year-old girl's first game ever, so it can't be too complex. Which is fine, I think Kirby games are also designed in the same way, but that franchise has more depth and spectacle to it. You're nonstop just doing crazy stuff in Kirby, but so far in Showtime, the pace hasn't ramped up that much. Yet, if you watch the trailers and think Showtime looks interesting, or if you're a Peach stan, or like Goodfield-style collectathons, I think this game has what you want. I do hope it does well, because I think the franchise has a lot of potential. Or hey, why not just team up Kirby and Peach? Like, what's stopping them? And huge news everyone, I beat Splatoon 3's newest DLC, Side Order. So it's time for some final thoughts on this very ambitious addition to the Splatooniverse. By beat, I mean I rolled credits. Did I 100% it? Or even 10% it? No, not at all. There's a deceptively large amount of content in Side Order, which is great for people who really get into it. And if you're like me who just wants to see the credits roll and then listen to another fantastic new song, there's still enough there to keep you interested until the end. If you're out of the loop, Side Order is the roguelite-inspired DLC, which is part 2 of the expansion pass. You ascend a tower fighting baddies and try to clear specific conditions, all while building up your abilities and skills to quickly grow stronger as you get closer and closer to the top. If you lose, you're back to square one and lose all your abilities. But there are permanent upgrades to make things easier. I was curious if the permanent upgrades would just let you eventually brute force the victory, and now I can say, sort of? There are definitely some vital ones, like extra lives, the Pearl Drone upgrades, one that makes specific power-ups appear more often so you can get a very specific build, and so on. But it does get to a point where you won't be able to buy anything significant after one run, and you'll need multiple tries to save up some prizes to buy an upgrade. But by the time you get to that point, you will probably have cleared it. According to the Splatoon 3 section of the Nintendo Switch Online app, something I know everyone checks every day, it took me 11 runs to hit the credits. It definitely felt longer because, unlike, say, Balatro, there's no one more run type of impetuous. Runs take about 30 or 40 minutes, and after you get wiped, you're probably exhausted if not a little frustrated. I had some great runs where I was cleaning house, but I picked the wrong stage and got wiped so close to the final boss. It's hard not to be annoyed and think I'm done after that. What really helped is doing just one run a day and having a goal in terms of what you want to do during the ascent and what permanent upgrade you plan on buying. With this mentality, I never felt like a run was pointless because I at least learned something or upgraded my character a bit to make the next run easier. But even with the inherent frustrations of getting wiped in a roguelite, the core gameplay is excellent. All the new enemies are unlike anything else in the series, and most of the challenges are completely fair. It really just is more Splatoon single-player content with a unique framing around it. And the single player of the Splatoon series, while it does get praised, I think people understate how great it is. I think you could easily buy Splatoon solely because of the single player mode. I actually saw somebody buy Splatoon 2 the other day, and I have to wonder if that's what he was doing. Side Order lets you use abilities in fun ways that you don't get to use in the multiplayer modes, and many of the challenge stages put you in wacky situations that really test your limits and Splatoon's skills. I love the one where the portals are spread out across the stage, but outside of these portals, it's just bouncy platforms, so you and the enemies are just plopping up and down in the air. There's also a Splat Zone stage that's huge, but it has those fish balloons that you can blow up, so eventually the battle just turns into you trying to pop these balloons over and over again. The A-ball stages from Octo come back, except this time they won't make you cry because you can't knock the ball off the stage, and even the goal kind of magnetizes the ball, so there's no crazy physics that will mess you up. The strength and joy of Side Order is doing all these creative challenges in the tower, but on top of that, you've also got the roguelike elements where you get more powerful by collecting color chips after clearing each floor. I was skeptical about how much this affected your character early on, and after rolling credits, you definitely see their effect, but they don't feel like game-changing upgrades, unlike in other rogue games. So many of the upgrades here are just buffing your weapon or giving the Pearl Drone new attacks, or increasing your ink refill and whatnot. I think this would have been a good opportunity to introduce completely new powers or abilities that were exclusive to Side Order, but everything you can do here, you can also do elsewhere in the game. The Poison Ink upgrade is a fun one where enemies get slower and take damage as they trudge through your ink, but there really aren't any other cool power-ups you pick up. In terms of builds, I think they're fairly limited, but I did only finish a run with the Splattershot, so maybe the other weapons encourage more specific or unusual builds. With Splattershot, a good upgrade is just boosting your attack and range, and also focusing on giving the Pearl Drone as many power-ups as possible, since she can do some crazy AoE damage and lets you focus on the objectives. For hardcore roguelike fans, rogueheads, I guess, the rogue elements of Side Order might be too simple or straightforward. It's not like Balatro, where every run forces you to adopt a completely new strategy and you can do all these crazy things. If you're coming to Side Order with the hope that you can make really, really crazy builds, you might be disappointed, but as somebody who just loves the core gameplay mechanics of Splatoon 3, I didn't mind that the roguelike elements were a bit light. Again, though, I think maybe I actually really haven't scratched the surface, as different weapons, of course, require different strategies. So what do you get if you beat the game? I won't get into spoilers, but there's still plenty of things to do and new weapons to try out. Plus, there are many, many unlockables for your oh-so-precious locker. I've already perfected the art of locker feng shui, but the stuff you get is pretty eye-catching. Unlike Octo, where you're mostly one and done, Side Order does want you to play it over and over again, even after you've rolled credits. But if you just hit the credits and dip like me, I still think it's a pretty satisfying game experience. It took, what, maybe 6 to 8 hours to see credits? That's about as long as Octo. And there's a lot more to do afterwards in terms of content, so you could easily argue that this is the meatiest Splatoon expansion yet. Also, it's kind of crazy that Splatoon 3 is almost like a Fortnite-esque hub, where you can focus on whatever you want. You could just do the multiplayer, or just play the ranked multiplayer with completely different modes. Or you can just focus on the Horde mode, aka Salmon Run, or maybe don't do either and just get really into the card game. And now you can just load up Side Order, play it as a roguelike, and ignore the rest. It's crazy how much content is in the game, and how you can really just pick what you want to do and go all in. In short, I'm very happy with Side Order, and if you're playing Splatoon 3 in 2024, it is definitely a must-buy. For lapsed fans, or people who are just curious because it's a roguelike, I think you should ask yourself how much you like the Splatoon mechanics in the single-player mode. If the answer is a lot, then you'll be satisfied. If you want something that completely flipped the game on its head, this isn't it. But at the very least, definitely look up the OST on YouTube because, obviously, the soundtrack is banger after banger. Splatoon is really unmatched when it comes to the visual style and music, as long as you don't care what's being said. Alright, that's it for games. Now for some news. Mario. He's back, and this time he's making big announcements moments after I published my last episode, thus making this the latest Mario Day 2024 update in podcast history. but I'm a huge Mario fan and my wife doesn't care about my Mario opinions, so I've got to get it out of my system somewhere. Miyamoto showed up and announced a new film, and I quote, based on the world of Super Mario Brothers. What does that mean? Is it a sequel? Why not just say, hey, we are making a sequel? Also, didn't they already announce a Donkey Kong project? Is this that? Or something different? It's dated for 2026, so if it's not just Mario 2, I really wonder when we are supposed to see Chris Pratt Mario again. I am probably overthinking this and this is just Mario 2, but maybe it has some strange name or there's some other element at play that makes it notably different from the first. If it is a sequel, I mean, you gotta introduce Wario and Waluigi, right? There really aren't a whole lot of distinct Mario big bad villains unless you dip into the spinoffs, which I doubt they would do. Mario and Luigi versus Wario and Waluigi, and of course, Bowser teams up with the good guys, maybe just temporarily. But the Bowser face turn is coming. He's too entertaining to be the emperor of the Mario movie universe. Also, we got dates on two upcoming remakes and or remasters. Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door is May 23rd, and Luigi's Mansion 2 is June 27th. Now, what's special about those dates? They are Thursdays. I didn't notice it at all, but Endless Ocean will also release on a Thursday. This is pretty bizarre, as I have to think Nintendo is introducing a new release strategy, replacing Friday with Thursday. I guess I should be happy, since Thursday is technically sooner, but I do like Friday releases because I can just focus on the game during the weekend instead of having to be distracted by all those pesky weekday responsibilities. Nintendo Switch Online also dropped Dr. Mario on NES along with Mario Tennis and Golf for the Game Boy Color. Tennis on GBC is awesome. It has a RPGS story mode, and the game is translated very faithfully from the N64 version. Definitely worth playing. Golf also seems to be of similar quality, but I've always been more of a tennis guy. Super Mario Land 1 is strangely still missing. I just want to play 1-1 and hear the song and then never play it again for another decade. Give me that, Nintendo. Also, a Lego version of a Mario Kart cart is coming, so neat. For some non-Mario Day Mario merch, Sané did announce that they will re-release the original Luigi's Mansion 2 plushies in late June in Japan. These include Polterpup and Luigi with the Poltergust. Don't get those two mixed up. These days, even the plushies are getting remastered. And Gelato Pique is releasing new pajamas themed after Peach, Daisy, and Rosalina. I can always count on Gelato Pique for some peak Nintendo merch. For non-Mario news, but still in the world of merch, there will be a new Animal Crossing-themed Ichiban Kuji raffle on March 26th. The big items include alarm clocks shaped like a radio with Isabelle and the Nooklings, a Brewster apron, and also packaging that looks like the items in the game. Like the blue fish bag? Am I explaining this well at all? Either way, you can win it soon. I've had some bad luck with Ichiban Kuji recently. I couldn't find the recent Splatoon one, couldn't find the Final Fantasy VII one. Have I been cursed after being able to find them so easily for years and years? If I can find this one, I'll definitely buy a ticket. More news, Unicorn Overlord, which I talked about last episode, is having some stock issues in Japan. It was the number one game in Japan during the week of its release, but since then it's been sold out all over the country and Atlus has said that they are working on printing more. Even just a few days ago, more than a week after its release, Big Camera was completely sold out of the Switch version. Hopefully this bodes well for its success, because I am still playing it, and it's a fresh take on the strategy RPG genre. I always wondered if Fire Emblem was the absolute limit for how much the genre could sell, but I'm happy there are some other success stories out there. SRPG, maybe a top 3 game genre, but we really don't see that many of them. I'll try to give some mid-game thoughts on Unicorn Overlord in an upcoming episode, so don't worry. Last piece of news, Arika, which you may know from Tetris 99 and the upcoming Endless Ocean, announced they are teaming up with SNK to, quote, revamp SNK IP. Both companies have agreed to collaborate to, again, quote, promote the revamp, reclaim, and revive of SNK IP. They also know that this doesn't solely include fighting games. Okay, honestly, not sure what this means. I like Arika, but I never thought that they were on the level of SNK in terms of wealth or notoriety. So it is a unique team up. Will this lead to Skullomania showing up in King of Fighters? Maybe. SNK doesn't really put out a whole lot of new games outside of King of Fighters, so a brand new entry in one of SNK's mini IPs would be exciting, especially non-fighting games. Outside of KOF, we did get a new Samurai Showdown and a new Garo game is on the way, but I'm trying to think of what non-fighting SNK IP could be brought back. If it's up to me, I would make another Card Fighters Clash, of course. Maybe a new Baseball Stars? Money Puzzle Exchanger 99? I have to assume whatever they're working on will come to a Nintendo console, so color me interested. Alright, let's wrap it up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on April 7th. See you next time. Matinee.